This is Christy Tennant Crispin with International Arts Movement, and you're listening to IAM Conversations. With the start of the new year, the IAM Readers Guild has just released its list of books for 2012. Each month, groups of people around the world, from Bangalore to Bozeman, will read and discuss one book each month. Curated by Megan Ritchie, the list includes classic and contemporary, English and non-English, fiction and non-fiction titles that embody some aspect of the mission of International Arts Movement, to wrestle with the deep questions of art, faith, and humanity in order to inspire the creative community to engage the culture that is and create the world that ought to be. For the first episode of this new year, I thought it would be most appropriate to highlight the first IAM Readers Guild book for 2012 by chatting with the book's author. So it's my pleasure to welcome the writer of Straw House, Woodhouse, Brickhouse, Blow, Daniel Nyeri. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
And Happy New Year to you.
You too.
You are the first guest for 2012, so I'm delighted.
Huzzah! Just in time for all those New Year's resolution book lists.
Exactly, I'm going to read more in 2012, and this is a great way to start. So, well, longtime listeners of this podcast will remember you from our 2009 interview, October of 2009, right, which was just after the release of your novel, Another Faust, and I think it was your first novel. Is that correct?
It was, yes.
So you were on a book tour at that time, and you were preparing to write the follow-up, Another Pan. And since then, you've had another book come out. So a lot's happened in the last couple of years.
It has, and I'm actually in-house now. I've been editing as well full-time for about 3 years.
Wow, that's amazing. So I would love to hear just kind of a little bit about the experience from when Another Faust came out. How did that go for you? You did a book tour, you did readings with your sister, and then you had Another Pan. And yeah, I just love to hear, kind of looking back on that, what do you remember most about that experience?
What do I remember most? Gosh, that's a tough question. It was a blur. It's been two and a half tours now, since then. So each one, getting a little bit more intense and more efficient, obviously. So the first one was about a sprawling month of, 9 states and lots of rental cars and hotel rooms and stuff like that. And, so from the first one, that's all I remember, honestly. It's like just tons and tons of speaking engagements. And then the second one, I had gone back to editing. I work at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, so the tour had to be 2 weeks, but we just managed to jam the same amount of events into 2 weeks. And I just got off of the one for Straw House. And that was another 2 weeks. So basically, I haven't had a vacation for the last 3 weeks, because those are, when you're working full time, you get 2 weeks off. So I take it off, and my wife is a very patient individual who's managed to take her vacations by herself the last 2 years. So on like a, quality of life front, I think these are the nose to the grindstone years. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I remember the most, if I was going to be really honest about it. Obviously, Straw House has been my baby for the last 3.5 years I've been working on it. Mm-hmm. So it's been the personal project this whole time. So the tour for that felt like a cakewalk. I was just, it's won so much of my affection, this project, that I had no, I can sort of bloviate on that subject forever.
Well, good, because that's what I want to talk to you about.
Oh, I'm sure they're looking forward to it. That's a good opening.
Yeah. So your first two books were inspired by specific titles from classical literature, and they were kind of modern reimaginings of those themes in those books. But and it was obvious from the titles that that's what you were doing. Right. This book seems to be more about exploring genres rather than titles. And I just would love to hear you talk a little bit about the premise behind these 4 novellas that make up the book.
Well, so Straw House, as you said, Straw House, Woodhouse, Brickhouse, Blow is 4 novellas. They're 100 pages each, each in a different genre. And a lot of people ask me, especially on the publishing side, professionals who were like, you could have just, they're long enough to be standalone projects. Like a lot of my favorite authors publish at that length.
Yes.
They're about, the stories are each about 35 to 45,000 words. So, there are just a slew of them. I mean, novels have gotten fatter since, but everyone from Flannery O'Connor to, the Michael Chabon's newest books, you know, they tend to be on the shorter side. So they said, why are they together? And I think there is the project for the sort of astute reader does have a connecting thread that makes the collection, I think anyway, enriched by sort of the interaction of the four stories. Mm-hmm. But the four stories are very different. They could have been standalone. Like Straw House, for example, is a Western about a farmer who grows toys and a rancher who grows people. Mm-hmm. And they obviously hate each other, as all Westerns, in all Westerns one must. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it leads to a showdown at high noon and this sheriff who's sort of stuck in the middle of it. And Woodhouse is it's effectively a sci-fi road trip about a young girl who gets caught up in sort of the worst technological disaster, mm-hmm. That, you know, that will ever happen, I guess. And then, you know, the third is a hard-boiled detective series about these cops who've got to go around catching all the evil wishes that kids make in New York City. Mm-hmm. And there's like a ton of evil wishes that kids make. And then the last one is like a it's like a comedic romance. It's set in old-timey Europe. It's like Disney's Europe, really, and mm-hmm. it's told Death's perspective. So it's like Doom with a View is the name of that one. Mm-hmm. And and of course they're all brought together by this umbrella theme that is the Three Little Pigs. They each sort of begin with an epigraph from the Three Little Pigs, and mm-hmm. in my opinion, have a lot of thematic resonance to that story. It kind of came out of this omnivorous appetite I tend to have for media. I'm one of those people who like goes home. I play a video game while listening to podcasts.
Right.
So it's really bad. Like during the load screen of a video game, I am playing listening to podcasts and playing something else. So. It just kind of comes from everywhere.
Yeah. Now, this was kind of as you already recognized, kind of a unique and possibly even somewhat risky device to put these four together in one place, because the same people who read Westerns are not always fans of sci-fi, you know, and people who read hard-boiled detective stories don't always love Shakespeare or love kind of, you know, romance. Were you at all concerned, or did you have full confidence that your audience would get the thread?
No, you can't ever say you have full confidence. I mean, maybe someday I can, but I certainly can't now. You write for the people like you out there. And I like to think that there are people out there who, you know, watch all kinds of things in terms of highbrow and lowbrow and play video games and, you know, read Kant. I mean, you kind of hope for those people because, you certainly are one. And so, I can't say I was super confident about that. There are other projects that have done similar things. I mean, Stephen King wrote a collection called Different Seasons that had, you know, a lot of people know the film versions of those four stories, Shawshank Redemption and mm-hmm. Stand By Me and mm-hmm. Apt Pupil. Like, those are like two of the four which became films, of them all-time classics.
Yes.
But for two very different films and for mm-hmm. very different audiences. Mm-hmm. So it was always inspired by that. By that collection. And so, you know, when it comes down to it in terms of the genre thing, Christy, I think you know this about me. I used to volunteer in high school at a library, and I always found this really amazing phenomenon that would happen, right? You would have an 18-year-old walk in, and you'd say, you know, you try to help them out, like give them a recommendation, and you'd be like, well, what kind of stuff do you like? And they just sort of shrug their shoulders and be like, oh, I don't know, you know? And you kind of have to prod it out of them. Like, you want to go into the sports section? Do you want to see this? And then you would meet these they were inevitably felt that they were, you know, older individuals who would go straight to the section, like their section. There were these, you know, old men who only read like Louis L'Amour books mm-hmm. or Zane Grey. And then there were these people who were just like Sue Grafton or, Mitch. And like the sweetest people on the planet, but they would read like incredibly brutal like murder mysteries mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. or, you know, the of course I forget the name of that one sort of shipfaring series, but you know, the seafaring series rather. Nonetheless, you had these people who had like discovered their obsession, and there's no way you could sort of recommend them off of it. So I guess for me as a kid, I discovered my obsession really early on. I felt I had a phase with Raymond Chandler's hard-boiled detective stuff mm-hmm. and with comics and stuff at that. So, you know, my hope, I suppose, is that, you know, as people are reading these, they sort of have that, like, serendipitous interaction with a genre that they normally wouldn't have known that will become that obsession. You know, if one can retroactively assign some good cause for their book, then I would say that that's what this book would do.
That's great. Yeah. No, I think it is a great way to, you know, to introduce people to different genres. I mean, I would certainly totally see that as something that, you know, that I would say, well, maybe you're not going to, you know, read an entire, you know, detective series, but, you know, check this out and see what you think of it, you know, because it's definitely something that, for me, you know, piques the curiosity. And
Someone once, I think it was a teacher once, told me that I, you know, my interests are a mile wide and an inch deep.
Oh, no.
And I think I mistakenly took that for a compliment.
Right. But
now it has become this thing where I am a dabbler, but not certainly in storytelling, but, you know, at least in the kinds of stories. Hopefully it'll spark some new interests.
Now, some people reading your books will just enjoy them as entertainment, and they may be thought provoking. They may get them thinking, you know, certainly about technology or about the relationships that people have. But others will look deeper and will see allegorical references to the relationship between God and humans. It kind of seems to be sort of throughout that. And I was thinking about this while I was reading your book. I was thinking about J.R.R. Tolkien, and he's famous for ardently denying any intention on his part to write allegory into his Lord of the Rings series. And, you know, he stated that he preferred applicability to allegory. So I was curious to know, how do you feel when readers read your books and project a specific theology?
I don't mind it at all. I mean, I think where he's probably being irked by the idea is the allegory feels like the cheapest kind of depth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of this very, mostly because it assigns one signifier or signified to each symbol, right? And so it's like, well, this means this and this means this. And so if you had the right, decoder ring, then you could just figure it all out. And so I think it may have insulted his hope, I can't speak to his mentality, but it certainly might insult someone's hope that there is a depth greater than one meaning to each story. And I think I like that. David James Duncan is a writer that I really enjoy, and I've always thought this was something he said, but I haven't been able to Google it and find it since. But it, you know, that sort of this idea that, you know, great works like a deep river will have many currents of different directions. And so I think if a work is deep, it must also be open to the possibility of misunderstanding and misinterpretation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally open to, you know, people reading it in any way that they would like. Obviously, I had my own thoughts on it and things like that, but I would never want my work to be so shallow a river that it only goes in one direction.
Right.
That would be terrible.
Yeah. And I don't think there's any fear of that.
Well, that's good.
So, I was curious about that. So I really appreciate hearing your thoughts on that. I read somewhere, actually, I think it was the press materials for your book, that you wrote this book on an iPhone. And I have to ask you about this. First of all, I need to ask you, does Apple know about this?
Actually, like about 3 years ago, I was oddly in a space with an Apple exec, and I told her about it. And she said, yeah, it was the first one she had heard of, because this was like, I was one of those technophiles who went and stood in line and bought the first generation iPhone. So I started writing it about 30 days after the phone came out.
And you had a pink cover on it, I remember.
Yes, that's right. And my big, fat, like arthritic sausage thumbs did not allow, there were no cut and paste. It was odd. A lot of people have asked about that because it was the sort of odd thing to do. And obviously from the press release, it was sort of, front and center. And, for me, it was, I'll tell you the real story behind it. I kind of jokingly pretend like I'm that kid who likes to paint the Mona Lisa on an Etch-a-Sketch.
Uh-huh.
But that's not really true. First of all, I don't think it's the Mona Lisa. Second of all, I'm terrible on an Etch-a-Sketch. But, it wasn't one of those things to me. I'll tell you the very sort of sincere reason it started as kind of a it's kind of an esoteric reason, so I shy away from telling people, but maybe this is a good spot for it. I was reading in 2007 a New York Times article. I think it was a New York Times article on this sort of phenomenon that was happening in Japan that they were, you know, was called the cell phone novel, right? Mm. And I'm that friend of mine, you know, among my peer group. I'm that guy who's like obsessed with like random trends happening in places like like Red Bull is crazy popular in Abu Dhabi right now and stuff like that. So yeah, and you're just kind of like, why is that? And I was fascinated with this article, and there were certain things that popped out about the article. Well, first of all, it made sure to sort of tell us that it's sort of a this form where what happens is there it was sort of predominated by you know rather it was dominated by sort of like 15-year-old girls who were all becoming sudden celebrities because they were writing these serial novels that were very, very salacious. Like it went out of its way to tell us how sort of sexually explicit these novels were. They often had really dark themes and yet they were selling really well. And so it was really an interesting article because it felt to me like a lot of the critics of the form were very bothered by the fact that these were very young people who were not sort of paying their dues in some sense, and they were not being deferential enough because they, you know, a lot of them were quoted for saying like they don't even like reading regular books and things like that, which is really onerous to someone who, you know, dedicates their life to it's like this new generation who just doesn't want to read anything that came before them. Obviously, I could see how that would be onerous, but the manner in which the attack sort of seemed to happen was that it was, oh, this is a very low form. Make sure, like, and the undercurrent felt to me, you know, was that, like, dear reader, please make sure not to respect these young ladies. Like, they're doing something obviously, you know, pop and schlocky. And I was like, wow. To me, it was one of those moments where I was like, this is maybe the first time in a long time I have read about a group of people thinking that a form of writing is transgressive.
Right.
You know, like when was the last time that ever happened? Like, I mean, if you think about it, and you know, like you got Picasso, right? And he comes along, and he's, you know, he's doing this sort of cubist thing, and you know, all these people are clutching their pearls and saying, you know, he's what is his form is in some way deteriorating our idea of an objective perspective, right? And so, just in and of itself, the form was transgressive to them. It wasn't the fact that he was drawing naked ladies, for example. It wasn't the content. Nowadays, we look at a Picasso and we've so, you know, ingested this idea of, you know, whatever you want to call it, the sort of intention of cubism. We've ingested it so much that the only thing we really care about is the content. And we're like, oh my gosh, naked ladies. So, you know, aside from the content of writing, very, very rarely has a form been controversial. Right. And so I was like, wow, I was at an IAM conference like 4 years ago where Miroslav Volf was talking about how artists are both transgressors and reconcilers.
Yes.
That, man, I know a lot of people refer back to that speech. He really nailed that one. And for me, I remember thinking, all right, this is a really transgressor. I get it. And I wanted to see if I could also go into that space that's obviously very low and make a sincere attempt at making something good. Now, that is such an esoteric reason to do something, you know? It's such a like personal reason. There was a lot of talk at the time of how like the cell phone novel may in fact kill the concept of the author, and you know, and the space of the cell phone is a landscape 1/4 of the size of a white page, and therefore the imagination is constricted. And I remember being like, wow, you really think that the imagination is constricted over, and to some extent maybe it is, the form definitely impart something into the content in the way that, like, we all talk about this, right? Like Dickens' serialized work changed his content because it was in some form. And so I, you know, I started thinking about all those things, and it got exciting. You know, why not? You know, I'm
right.
So these were the real reasons I started writing on the cell phone.
Wow.
It was cool. I enjoyed it. When people ask, I'm like, oh, it's because I was on a plane and all the movie. What else are you gonna? Otherwise, you have to like be like, what do you think about artists as transgressors?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, maybe that's what you should do.
Maybe I would come off as much as I probably did as this like blowhard, but you know, that's stuff I'm interested in. So why shouldn't I pursue it?
Did you use a specific app? What app did you use?
I used the Notepad app, which comes with the app. At the time, like, like so few, there were so few. And so I did that. There was no cut and paste. It was actually I came up with my own sort of like code system.
Wow.
To sort of like replace cut and paste. It's really hard to explain verbally, but basically if I wanted to move a passage like up three pages, I would bracket it off and put a symbol next to it. And then that symbol would be input into, you know, two pages up so that I would know to go down. And, you know, wow. So everything was based. So by the end, there would be whole passages that were nothing but symbols representing other passages.
Wow.
It's a really weird document to look at.
It'd be amazing for you to put that up on your website and let people see a little sample of it.
You know, Flannery O'Connor, I know, showed manuscripts, you know, rough manuscripts, and she was far braver than I think I'll ever be, because I don't want people to see my dirty laundry.
Right. Yeah. Well, but, and you know what? There's a reason that there's a process and we get the final version.
That's right. I don't
Many
know,
eyes like, have looked over it before it gets to the public.
True. Her first draft is something to be aspired to, probably.
Yeah. No, that's true. So. One of the other things I loved about this book, and this is something you couldn't have done on your iPhone, was the incredible art that you included in it. Can you talk a little bit about just how you decided to go about that and who the artists were who were featured and just maybe talk a little bit about the art that you featured in this book?
Sure. Well, the illustrator for the first book and the sort of chapter openers on Toy Farm each have a different toy that is being illustrated, and that was done by James Weinberg, who is a wonderful illustrator in I believe he's in Massachusetts, and he was chosen by the illustrator for any sort of interior. The book is actually the publisher's domain. So he was chosen by the editor. I mean, obviously, you know, they're kind enough to let me take a look and, you know, sort of approve if, you know, there's
quote unquote.
Exactly. I would never presume that it's my approval, but honestly, I saw his first sketches and was so blown away that I was like, it was a moot point, but it was a brilliant work. People ask if I had in the manuscript asked for illustrations, and the answer is yes. I really thought the illustrations were important for that particular story, because it's a story about these toys that are growing up, and they're coming out of the ground as plants do, and they have life, right? They have this sort of like animus that and the farmer is obviously doing by some process giving them this life, and then they're sort of, the farm is placed under siege by this rancher who's growing people. They're homunculi, or these sort of plant men who are grown, and it sort of goes into like there's a lot of mythology around homunculi, but they're soulless. They don't have they don't have soul, and so this rancher is effectively trying to figure out what's inside these toys that makes them come alive. And so there is in fact a few toys that die, and so in my mind I was like, how. You know, and in the story, it is the reaction that the characters give is the same reaction one would give to a pet or a human or a friend, anyone dying. Like it is tragedy. And so I wanted to some extent for the illustrations to be there to show us a toy. The toy is being hung, and it's always like it's like a dollhouse, right? And you can't obviously kill a dollhouse by hanging it. You can't kill a, so it's, to me, it sort of had this perfect balance of a very jarring image that is in and of itself ineffective, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, to put a noose around a jack-in-the-box's neck is very, very jarring, and yet on the cosmic scale, not in any way effective. to me, that was really important, this idea that, like, the death of these toys wasn't... sort of all there was.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Inconsequential, but at the same time, it wasn't all there was. And so I thought that was very important in a world where the farmer has to stay silent, because the farmer effectively, is this sort of figure that stays in the farmhouse, and there's a lot of, our main character is this 18-year-old boy who's effectively the entire struggle of the story for him is that, like, why isn't this man who's sort of supposed to protect these toys, why isn't he like coming out with a vengeance down from, this like farmhouse on a hill and protecting this farm. Mm-hmm. And so that's the big thing. And of course, he sort of lashes out and he hates the farmer for it and all these reasons. But I wanted there to be a silent answer. You know, if the answer effectively that the farmer would have given if he were to speak to this main character, to say, like, effectively that argument, that side of it. And I didn't want it to be spoken, so I thought the illustration was a great way of doing it.
That's great. I'd love to kind of finish our time by asking you to talk a little bit about the role of community in your artistic practice, in your writing. You were part of the first class, if you will, of what was then called the I Am Fellows program, but now it's called the Working Artists Initiative, and it's continuing on, and new classes are starting. Can you share a bit about what that experience was like and how that, or the broader idea of being in community with other artists, has affected has affected your writing practice?
Sure. The in community with other artists thing, I think everyone's art is sort of, you're sort of, when you send it out into the public marketplace, you're always going to be in community in some form mm-hmm. of community with mm-hmm. other artists insofar as, you know, these things converse with one another. Mm-hmm. I think the problem, of course, stems I think sort of endemic to our time is that both critics and artists aren't quite listening. there's a lot of sort of, and now let me talk, which I'm sure I've been doing nothing but talking in this
place. Well, that's the point of this, but that's okay.
That's fair. But, I personally was really excited when that program started, and Carrie Wallace, who's an artist that I really admire, had brought together not just writers, but artists on all these sort of different media. You know, there were Wayne Adams, who's a painter, and we had singer-songwriters, we had all sorts, photographers. And so, in addition to the fact that there was a certain advantage to getting a diverse pool of people to not only talk with, but hear from, mm-hmm. I thought it was a very great opportunity to sort of teach listening, mm-hmm. which is very important. For me, I have a day job, so part of that discipline of the everyday, which is also something the community provides, was something that I had inherent in my day-to-day, just because I have to wake up and, I carve out my 2 hours of personal space before I go to work. So for me, that part, and I know that's a huge, huge element of what community gives, is that sort of accountability. I think among artists, you know, how many times can you go to, like, even a party or a fellowship like this, and you sit down and someone says, "What are you working on?" Mm-hmm. If, like, 3 weeks in a row you say the same thing, yeah. Then you really start to feel that sort of horrible, you know, unproductive feeling. And so I think it delivers a lot of that. For me, there was this added element of just being able to hear other people. And I think that was a huge, huge lever for me. I had a great time in that. And to this day, I sort of end up having to do a lot more reading, because mm-hmm. to actually counterbalance the fact that it's no longer a part of my life.
Right.
But right. It's can be fraught.
Well, maybe we can create the second the kind of Working Artist Initiative, 2.0. Exactly.
That'd be great. I'd love. I think that's a lot of what the artist communities have to do and have done, and like historically people talk about all the famous ones.
Yeah.
But that you just kind of have to meet up and talk about these things.
What are you working on now? Speaking of.
That's it. That is definitely the hot seat. I'm actually working on, so these four stories were four really Western genres to, mm-hmm. You know, obviously, at the hard-boiled detective was, Raymond Chandler, that era, 1940s of L.A. And, you got sci-fi, which sort of has its roots in the U.K. and U.S. and the Western, obviously. Mm-hmm. So now, in my mind, it was always I wanted to do four very Eastern genres next. Mm. So I've actually finished two more novellas. I'm working on the other two for sort of a companion collection. And, you know, one of them is a Arabian Nights tale. One of them is a sort of a travelogue kind of. Before Marco Polo, there was this guy named Ibn Battuta who wrote about travels. And so this is a travelogue story about, set on the Silk Road in the 10th century. And so the waning years of the Silk Road. And then what else? There will be a sort of a parable and an anime. So it's a modern Eastern genre in there, and so it's kind of an East-West kind of collection that two together. And Rushdie wrote a really great essay collection called East-West, and all about about a lot of things. But you know, it sort of touched on certain themes of, you know, immigrating from the East to the West, and mm-hmm. and having sort of a foot in both. It's playing out, I suppose, in my creative life that way.
Well, that sounds fantastic. You are always full of surprises, and every time I talk to you, I'm so inspired. So really appreciate you taking time to speak with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is great.
For more on Daniel Nayeri, you can visit him on the web at danielnayeri.com or follow him on Twitter at Daniel Nayeri. And if you'd like to learn more about the I Am Readers Guild, which kicks off this month with Daniel's book, visit www.iamreadersguild.com, where you'll find the entire list of books, links for purchasing them from the IAM store, and the free discussion guide that you can use to host your own group. If you've been looking for a way to get involved with IAM, this is a great way to do that, just hosting or joining an IAM Readers Guild. And like we said at the beginning, it's a great way to accomplish your New Year's resolution to read more. Daniel, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Also, I don't know if you know, but on my site, for book groups, I actually do Skype in with them afterwards.
Oh, I did not know that.
That's, I do.
Awesome. So yeah, you could have a personal appearance from the author himself. That would be fantastic. Great. Well, you know, and if you're listening and you do that, please let us know about it. We'd love to hear how that goes. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kristen.